Welcome back. In my last lecture, I talked about the influence of evolutionary schemes in archaeology. I talked about the development of unilinear evolutionary theories in the 19th century. These theories were extremely ambitious. They posited that there existed a common evolutionary trajectory for societies across the entire world at all periods of time, and that this trajectory involved a whole system of economic, political, social, even religious and ideological characteristics. I noted as well that the band, tribe, chiefdom, state system, trajectory, that I've been talking about could be considered as one particular form of unilinear evolutionary scheme, albeit a much more restricted and in many ways much better supported system than those vast systems, because it is only political. It looks at the development of political systems through time. One of the challenges that archaeologists face when studying the origins of ancient states is quite simple. How do we decide, using only archaeological data, that something called a state in some area of the world has developed from some non-state ancestor? Fairly simple question. How do we tell when states do appear in the archaeological record? Remember that this may be a very gradual process. We may be looking at the slow, steady progression of political and social and economic systems from one form toward another. In other cases, it may be quite sudden. So one of the questions, then one of the things we have to think about, is how we expect this transition from non-state to state to happen in terms of speed, suddenness. In some cases, as in early dynastic Mesopotamia and Egypt, for example, we have written evidence available. That written evidence talks about kings and wars and diplomacy and the functioning of the state. And so it's a pretty obvious indication that ancient states of one form or another, with a whole variety of different kinds of characteristics, exists in these particular areas at these particular times. In other parts of the world, though, those data may not exist. If we take a look, for example, in the Indus Valley, on the border between India and Pakistan, the ancient civilization that we know as the Indus Valley Civilization, it's sometimes called Harappan. Here we have an extraordinary urban society, a large and vital and complex cultural system that involved writing. But we can't read it. The writing system hasn't been deciphered, and so we don't know what it says about the functioning of the state. In other parts of the world, in Great Zimbabwe, for example, in southeastern Africa, or at the origins of the Inca state in South America, writing itself did not exist. And so that origin, that source of information, is not available to us. In addition, since writing seems to, in most cases, appear at a time when states already existed, it doesn't provide us with much information on their development from earlier political forms. In fact, the earlier forms of writing, the earliest forms of writing in Mesopotamia, in Egypt, for example, seem to have to do with other areas of concern, other sorts of cultural activities, particularly economic ones, for example, they don't provide us with much evidence on political organization. Evolutionary models may provide us with ways of determining when states appear in the archaeological record, but they also then require that we accept that these models are generally accurate when applied to the real world. And this has actually been an issue of significant debate in archaeology over the last 10 to 15 years. After some decades, when that particular model of change between band, tribe, chiefdom, and state were generally accepted. We see more and more doubts expressed now about among archaeologists about the general applicability of that succession, band, tribe, chiefdom, state. Let's recapitulate just for a moment. We have at the base of this system the band. The band is associated primarily with forager, hunter-gatherer societies. It involves small populations, 50 people perhaps. Political power in a band is very much decentralized. Bands are generally egalitarian. They actually work hard at being egalitarian in many ways. Rank in band-level societies is based on considerations of age, gender, and skill levels. Next, we come to the tribe. Societies organized at this level of social and political integration are primarily agricultural. They may contain populations of hundreds or thousands of people. They are sedentary. They are no longer mobile, moving across the landscape. Social hierarchy is generally weakly developed in tribe-level society. Political authority is often vested in some kind of communal leadership, for example, a council of elders. Chiefdoms. I've been talking about chiefdoms quite a bit, and I'll talk about them some more for reasons that I'll get into in a few minutes. Again, farming populations, a variety of different population sizes. Again, thousands, tens of thousands of people in some cases. But here we see hereditary inequality, the development of stratified differences in rank and status that can be inherited from one generation to the next. Mechanisms of coercion are still not highly developed, particularly in simple chiefdoms. And then finally, the state. And here we come, in a sense, to the crux of the matter. A central government, societies with a central government, four primary characteristics. A stable political hierarchy, usually with a single ruler. A state bureaucracy of some form. The existence of mechanisms of coercion, police or military forces, for example. And a redistribution system. A system through which resources are gathered in from society and as taxes and tribute, for example, and then some proportion of those resources are redistributed within the community, for example, as public works, as support for military and bureaucratic systems, and so on. It's notable that the cases from which the band, tribe, chiefdom, state succession model was formulated are all recent ethnographic or historical cases. We know of relatively few circumstances where succession between these stages has been observed. So, in a sense, if we think of the band, tribe, chiefdom, state model as a particular kind of evolutionary sequence, then we have a significant issue. Under circumstances in which all our examples are recent, or at least are not historically connected to one another, how do we recognize true evolutionary sequences in the past? How do we know where they existed in the past? This is especially a problem when we realize that the political environments within which state formation might happen have changed out of all recognition over the last five centuries, and possibly in some areas before that. If we had this circumstance, then, in which all of our examples of these different stages of an evolutionary sequence are recent or modern ones, where do we ever see evolution actually taking place? This does not invalidate the model, but it does increase the risk of circular reasoning, where we detect such cases in the past because they are what the model tells us to expect from more recent times. And it may tend to blind us to interesting alternatives. Might, for example, chiefdoms, in fact, be an alternative political form to the state, not necessarily an ancestral one? Might, in the same way, tribes and chiefdoms exist in a cyclical relationship with one another? There are cases known from Burma and Central Africa, for example, where this seems to be the case. In these instances, we seem to have a regular cycling between these different political forms, between states and chiefdoms, or between tribes and chiefdoms, without any form of collapse. This is not, for example, a situation where we could talk about the collapse of a state-level society, but rather a regular alteration and alternation of political forms. This was the basis of a famous book by a British anthropologist named Edmund Leach, written in the 1950s and entitled Political Systems of Highland Burma. In this Burmese case, structural tensions within a single society, that of Kachin Highland farmers, causes an oscillation between radically egalitarian and quite hierarchical socio-political relations within a single society, but without changing the fundamental structures that bring these relations into being. Thus, this oscillation continues through time, never finally settling into either state or non-state modes. Where I work in Central Africa, in the Lake Chad Basin, and in an area that I've mentioned before and that we will look at later in the course, the same situation seems to hold. From archaeological and historical evidence, it seems that the degree of political centralization and social hierarchy is somewhat dependent upon local economic and political circumstances. And the communities can move back and forth along a spectrum of political integration, from relatively centralized to relatively decentralized and back, according to changes in these different economic and political and social circumstances. Now, we note that this isn't collapse in any form. In neither of these cases, in the Burmese case nor in the Central African case, can we talk about these societies collapsing. They're moving between alternate social political states. And the potential to exist in these different socio-political states is inherent in the social and cultural and political systems of the region. Would it, equally, be possible to move directly from simple chiefdoms, or possibly even from tribal levels of political organization, to at least simple states, depending on how we define the latter, without passing through a stage of more complex chiefdoms? Could we skip over one of these stages. Well, presumably we're not going to go from bands directly to states, from foragers directly to kings, but could we skip over at least one of the intermediate stages in some cases, perhaps from tribes to states? There are some areas where we are going to at least see this possibility come up. Thus, for example, along the Pacific coast of Peru, at about 3000 BC, there seems to be quite a sudden, and here I mean sudden in archaeological terms, that is within a couple of centuries, shift from fairly decentralized, small-scale societies to societies capable of constructing extremely large and impressive edifices, pyramids in some areas, and we have to think about pyramids being built on the coast of Peru at the same time as they're being built in Egypt, more than 2500 BC. One question is whether what appears to be a sudden shift in the potential to construct extraordinary architecture and the need to construct extraordinary architecture, whether it be political need or religious need, one question is whether this implies a real shift in social and political systems. It's hard to deny that something like that's going on, that there's been an extraordinary change in the Pacific coast of Peru in terms of social and political organization. But the question is it a state? Is this the first appearance of states in this part of South America? The same questions arise in the Indus Valley, in the Harappan civilization that I mentioned. There, the period of transformation is around 2500 BC. There's a sort of revolutionary century at about 2500 BC. And afterwards, urbanism appears. States seem to appear. Can we fit that kind of revolutionary case within an evolutionary scheme of band, tribe, chiefdom, state? That's a conundrum. Can we have states? Let's explore some other alternatives. Can we have states without some of the various characteristics that are said to define this political form? The appearance of centralized governmental systems. Well, it seems a little unlikely that we can have a state without some sort of centralized government. It's kind of central to the definition. How about a monopoly over the legitimate use of force internally and externally? I mentioned that is one of the characteristics of the state. But if we speak, for example, of feudal Europe, medieval Europe, and the feudal states that existed in various parts of Western Europe during the Middle Ages, for example, where was the monopoly over the legitimate use of force? Certainly not in the hands of the ruler. Can we have states without the existence of bureaucratic forms of state control? In some cases, I would argue yes, probably we can, or at least with extremely simplified bureaucracies. One of the states that I work with in Central Africa, the Wandala state, one of the pre-colonial states, it appears in many ways that the bureaucratic administration of the Wandala state was restricted to the court of the king, to the court of the sultan, and that it really didn't, through most of the 18th and 19th century, extend to any distance beyond that. Can we have states without some kind of redistribution system? Perhaps we can. Perhaps we can think, for example, of predatory states, states that extract from tributary populations but give almost nothing back. Again, some of the state-level societies south of Lake Chad in Central Africa appear quite predatory. They sustain themselves, they sustain the court, which is a significant part of the state. They sustain the elite through slave raiding. Where's the redistribution in that? Archaeologists worry about these issues. Not just theoretically, not just because we like to worry about them, but because we want to make the best use possible of often fragmentary data when we're trying to understand political developments in the past. We're not able, under most circumstances, to assemble the panoply of data that would allow us to answer these questions definitively. We have fragments of data from different parts of the world, particularly at the origins of the state, particularly concerning the origins of the state. We want to be able to best deploy that data in order to understand what's going on in the past. Archaeologists, we always say we hate theory, but everyone uses it, explicitly or implicitly, and under those circumstances, it's best if we use it explicitly and consciously. These questions I've raised lead to widespread disagreements among archaeologists about whether particular ancient societies did or did not make the transition to statehood at some particular time. We argue about whether a particular ancient society was a state or whether it was not yet a state. We argue about when in a particular region states first appeared. Norman Yaffe, an archaeologist who works in Mesopotamia and is one of the leading critics of these earlier evolutionary models of political development, has proposed Yaffe's rule. If you can argue about whether a society is a state or isn't, then it isn't. And needless to say, even this formulation is criticized by other archaeologists because we're generally a fairly contentious group. Yaffe has also advanced a set of myths, as he calls them, myths of the archaic state, that he believes are accepted pretty uncritically by archaeologists. These myths are various. Let's go through them. The myth that the earliest states were all basically the same kind of thing, which is in a sense inherent in universal evolutionary models. Yaffe would look for far more diversity in the characteristics and modes of functioning of ancient states. Another myth, ancient states were totalitarian regimes. We must ask ourselves, how much power could these early states actually exert? How much potential for coercion did they actually have, particularly at some distance from the center? This is going to be a vital question as we begin to consider how particular ancient states were able to control territory. Another myth, or at least one of Yaffe's myths, the earliest states enclosed large regions and were territorially integrated. What Norm Yaffe, to an extent, is criticizing here is a conception of ancient states, early state-level societies, as equivalent to modern nation-states. Large regions, large territories, and general territorial integration, the idea that within a territory claimed by a state, all parts of the state are equally incorporated into state functioning. I am standing now in the territory of the United States of America, and wherever I go in that territory, the laws and norms and rights and duties of an individual living in that territory exist in the same way everywhere. When I go back home to Maine, laws are not going to apply in a less stringent or less significant way to me because I'm moving away from the capital of the United States in Washington, D.C. But that may not be the case for ancient states. Perhaps we will find that ancient states were not, in fact, territorially integrated. Another myth, that typologies, like the typology band, tribe, chiefdom, state, can be used to analyze states on a ladder of progressiveness. So what Yaffe is criticizing here is the very idea that we can establish typologies of this sort, band, tribe, chiefdom, state, and then use them to look at the ways in which states progress through time, in which societies progress towards statehood. So this is a fairly significant critique of the evolutionary approaches that I've been talking about. Another myth, that we can correlate these ancient types of political systems with modern societies, that we can use modern societies to directly understand these ancient political systems. And finally, that structural changes in political and economic systems were the only engines for the evolution of early states. This is something we'll look at further. Is there, for example, a role for ideology, for religion, for worldview as a mover, a driving factor in the development of early state-level societies, or is it just politics and economy? Yaffe believes that there's significantly more variability in early states than can be accounted for in simple systems of cultural evolution. He believes that early states may not look as we might expect them to look based on recent examples, which is, in a sense, ethnographically, all we have to go on. One result of these debates and of general uncertainty about evolutionary models is something that we're going to see repeatedly through the lectures in this course. Many of the societies that we're going to look at are going to be designated as chiefdoms. We're going to see this term come up again and again and again, and it's one of the reasons why I talk a lot about this category of chiefdom. In a sense, this isn't hard to understand. As that category, chiefdom, if one utilizes this developmental scheme, band, tribe, chiefdom, state, chiefdoms are the default option before the appearance of states. Therefore, for archaeologists uncertain about whether some ancient cultural manifestation or political manifestation was actually a state, that uncertainty is going to lead them to designate it as a chiefdom. And so, as we go through this course, we're going to see chiefdoms designated in a whole variety of different parts of the world, often referring to societies with very different characteristics. I tell my students at Bowdoin in my classes that when archaeologists talk about ritual objects or ritual behavior in the past, it's a signal that we don't actually understand what's going on. And similarly, talking about chiefdoms in the past is in too many cases a tacit admission of the same uncertainty, the same lack of understanding about ancient political systems. Use of that default option is in itself an illustration of some of the problems and challenges with general evolutionary models in archaeology. Now, it's unlikely that this question of general models in archaeology will be resolved at any time soon. Although certainly as we engage in fieldwork, as we step away from the classroom and the theory and actually do what archaeologists love to do, which is dig things up, we're learning far more about particular cases and particular regions. As I said, there's a continuing tension in archaeology between general comparative explanations, which are useful for examining cultural change on a global scale, and fidelity to the particulars of local and regional history. This is a tension, if you like, between science and history. That tension is probably not amenable to any final resolution. And in fact, it's probably a good thing. It's been very fruitful in advancing archaeological research. Thank you.